Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Everyday Anarchism, and let's get to it. Hello, Cory Doctorow. Thank you for coming back on the show.
Oh, it is my pleasure. Thank you for having me back on.
So I think this is our third time speaking, and the other times have been about the work of David Graeber. And this time we are here to talk about, I meant to have you on for Choke Point Capitalism. I never got around to it. Maybe we still can someday in the future, but I almost feel bad recording a podcast about enshittification, because I assume every podcast in the world is going to be releasing an episode about enshittification in October. But this one's mine.
Well, you know what? I think that there's plenty of nuance. I think a lot of people think they understand what enshittification is about, and maybe that's one of its strengths, right? Is that it starts with this high-level, simple, easy-to-understand pattern of decay among platforms, but it really gets into a pretty thorough economic, technical, and political assessment of how we got here, and I think more importantly, what to do about it.
Yeah, and let me just say, I agree. I mean, look, the book is great, Cory. I loved it. I smiled the whole time I was reading it. Obviously, I've seen a lot of this stuff already because I get your newsletter, and you use Yanis Varoufakis's work, and I've had him on. I mean, but it's put together in a way that I think anyone can understand and appreciate. And so just first, thank you for writing this book. It was fantastic.
Well, that's very kind of you. You know, I am a very iterative worker. I have this blog and I do a lot of talks. And so I will play with lots of different ways of presenting the material, trying to figure out what resonates with people, how to organize it. I think one of the weird and unheralded nature advantages of doing threads on social media is that you kind of break the argument down into these like individual stanzas, and then you find out which ones resonate with people. Like you literally get responses on a per paragraph basis that helps you figure out where things are going and where they aren't. And the same is true really, with people who live blog a talk. Because, you can see which lines are landing with the audience based on the ones that they're quoting and typing into their phones while you're giving the talk.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of it this way. So James C. Scott, in one of his books, writes about how MLK would give, when he would give his speeches and his sermons, he could tell, which ones were getting the biggest reaction. And so this thing that we think of as this, like, natural or maybe like honed thing, charisma, actually comes from call and response. Obviously, traditionally, yeah, People who write books are thought of as being out of this loop. But if you're on social media and you're giving talks, you're honing this material. It's like a stand-up comic or something. That's fantastic.
Yeah. And you know who else does this, obviously, is Trump, right? And you see him, like, Trump's a bullshitter, right? He spitballs. That's, I think, the biggest difference is he says things he doesn't believe to see which thing rubes, get excited about. But, he's doing this kind of same call and response.
Yeah. No, I agree. Although, I mean, we don't need to spend too much time on this. I think he's lost it. Lately, I think
sure.
He's just, we've all seen the older relative who can't do what they used to do. And that's where I think Trump is now.
I mean, I think maybe relevant to this group, one of the last events that I went to before lockdown was a Bernie Sanders rally here in LA. And you know how these things go. There's a string of warm-up acts, right? One after the other, after the other. And one of them was Dick Van Dyke, who was at this point in his 90s. And the guy is a national treasure, clearly.
Oh, yeah.
But he thought that he was the last act before Bernie came on. So he's like watching the wings and watching for Bernie to step up. And Bernie's not stepping up. And he's a trooper. So he starts spitballing. He's like vamping to give Bernie time to make it to the stage. And at a certain point, he's like, and people think that it was wrong to nuke Japan. But honestly, in retrospect, I think nuking Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and it's like, he is just spitballing. And again, I think that like 10 years ago, I don't even know if Dick Van Dyke believes it, but I think 10 years before he might have had the executive function to say, yeah, maybe this is like, I know I'm vamping here, but maybe not this vamping.
Oh, wow. Wow. Yeah. Oh, So, I mean, I'm gonna segue from there to this idea of inshittification, considering that we're talking about, you know, Trump is inshittifying. And this, as you say in the book, the word inshittification just means things getting worse or getting shittier. And it's hard to find anyone who isn't like a billionaire investing in AI or investing in like weapons tech who doesn't think that the world is inshittifying. That's, everyone agrees on that. And so inshittification, everyone's like, yeah, this book is right in the broad strokes. Can you, for anyone who hasn't listened to one of the 1 million podcasts where you've explained inshittification, take it to the next level and explain how platforms inshittify? And you can pick any of them. I mean, you've done this, sure. You've done almost all of them in the book.
Well, I will gently correct you, because while I'm happy to have people use inshittification to mean things are getting worse, I don't want that to be the only thing that it means. It does have this precise technical meaning that I've assigned to it as well. I'm never going to scold you for using it colloquially. English, its great strength is that it doesn't have any official usage.
Well, I mean, let me just say, the fact that people know that everything's getting worse lets you say, and do you know why inshittification is happening? It's not just,
indeed,
oh my God, why things are getting inshittified. Right. It's, this is it. So tell us what it is.
So inshittification is a thesis to both describe how platforms go bad and also to explain why they're all going bad now. And finally, to propose a remedy to do something about it. And so it's a pretty complex and nuanced technical set of ideas, but I'll give you the very top line and I'll use an example here. So the pathology of inshittification, the pattern of platform decay, starts with platforms being good to their end users and then finding a way to lock those end users in. So you have Facebook, for example, which when it opened up to anyone in the world and not just people with an American college email address with a .edu at the end of it in 2006, made this pitch that was like, look, I know you've already got an account on MySpace, but MySpace is full of ads and the evil billionaire who owns it, Rupert Murdoch, he spies on you all the time. Come to Facebook. We are the platform that will never, ever spy on you. And all we will do is show you the things that you asked to see, and we'll never put things in your feed that you never asked to see. So people flocked in, and they also locked in, because with social media, we get locked in by something called the collective action problem. And, you know, I think anarchists understand this, right? You love your friends, but they're a pain in the ass. You can't agree on what board game the six people in your group chat are going to play this weekend. So when there's 200 of you and you're all on Facebook and some of you are there because, you know, you share a rare disease and there's a support group there for you, or that's where the people who live in the country you emigrated from are keeping in touch with you, or it's how you keep in touch with the parents in your kids' little league and plan the carpool, or it's where your customers or your audience is, you know, it's very hard to convince all those people to go. So you have this collective action problem. And because those relationships are so valuable to you, you've got a high switching cost. You have to give up a lot to leave Facebook. And Facebook understands this. So it's time to move on to stage two, which is making things worse for end users in order to lure in business customers. And so Facebook, understanding that it's hard for you to leave now, starts to undo the deal that it had offered you in order to make things better for other groups. So they go to the advertisers and they say, hey, you remember we told these rubes we weren't going to spy on them? Well, we're spying on them from asshole to appetite. And for small dollars, we will locate with extreme precision the targets for your ads. And not only that, but because we're such, you know, generous people, we're paying a building full of engineers to just police ad fraud. And if you give us a dollar to show an ad to a specific user, that's the ad that we're going to put out, and it's going to be seen by that user. You're not going to lose money to fraud. And they go to publishers and they say, hey, remember we told these rubes we were only going to show them to the things that they asked to see. Of course, we were lying about that too. Put excerpts from your website onto Facebook, put a link back to your website. We'll just like non-consensually cram it into the eyeballs of people never asked to see it. And they will visit your website. They might subscribe to your feed. It's a free traffic funnel. And so the business customers pile in and they get locked in too. And this is something I think that is not well understood. I think a lot of people understood the platforms made things worse for their end users. But if you follow theses like Shoshana Zuboff's surveillance capitalism ideas, you might think that the division is platform owners and advertisers on one side and users on the other. But the reality is that platform owners are being just as rotten to those business customers. You know, just because you're paying for the product doesn't mean you're not the product. So advertisers see the price of ads go way up, and they see the fidelity of ad targeting go way down, and they see the amount of ad fraud explode beyond all recognition. So Procter & Gamble had been spending $200 million a year on what they call programmatic ads, but which are really surveillance ads. They zeroed out that $200 million a year spend, and they saw a 0% drop in sales, because to a first approximation, no one saw a Procter & Gamble ad. It was $200 million worth of ads just disappearing down the fraud hole. And publishers, they found that they had to add more and more of their content to that excerpt just to have it shown to their own subscribers, let alone to have it recommended, until eventually they were publishing a fully substitutive duplicate of the copy on their website. And then Facebook started punishing them if they linked to the website on the grounds that maybe that's a malicious link. And so you have publishers becoming commodity back-end suppliers to the platform, and the platform just squeezes them harder and harder. And, you know, because we tend to view things through a consumer lens, we know a lot about monopoly, which is where you have a powerful seller. We don't know as much about this monopsony, where you have a powerful buyer. And this is something where maybe if you're a progressive, you've thought about this in the context of labor markets, where, you know, if you live in a company town and there's only one employer, they can really squeeze you. But, you know, if you're just a supplier to a platform, if you're an advertiser or publisher, they can really squeeze you too. And it's much easier to capture a seller than it is to capture a buyer. And once you think about it for a second, it's easy to understand why. So imagine that you're a business and 20% of your receipts come from one customer, and that customer decides to stop buying from you. So you have a little coffee shop, and 20% of your day's sales are a giant business next door that orders coffee for everyone. And every morning you get up and you 20% of your revenue is just making coffees and bringing them next door. And that's the whole business. They stop. You're going to have to lay off half of your staff, not 20% of your staff, half of your staff. You might not make the mortgage. You might not make the rent. You might not be able to roll over your loans for the espresso machines. You might go out of business, right? Whereas if you are a coffee drinker, and there's five coffee shops on your way to work, and one of them goes out of business, and you lose 20% of the possible purchases, you don't have any trouble getting another coffee. And so monopsony is much easier to create and maintain than monopoly. And so you have the platform in its final stage, in stage three, where it is withdrawing the surplus from publishers and advertisers, withdrawing the surplus from end users. The amount of content in our feed has dwindled to a kind of homeopathic residue. The resulting void is being filled with things that people are paying to shove there, advertisers and publishers, but they're getting ripped off too. And all of the excess is being harvested by the business, by its executives, and by its shareholders. And the platform wants to sit in this knife edge equilibrium of having harvested all the value save the merest residue needed to keep us locked to each other and to keep the businesses locked to us. And that's when it turns into a pile of shit. And that's why we keep using it after it stopped being good for us. And as to why this is happening now, it's because there used to be consequences for doing this. When there were competitors, when we enforced antitrust law, when companies couldn't buy their direct competitors, whether that's Facebook buying Insta or Google buying everything, they had to worry about us leaving. When there were lots of companies in a sector, they had to compete with one another, and they found it hard to capture their regulators because they had different ideas about the best way to run that business. But once they converge into five giant firms, they all have exactly the same business model, and they lobby with one voice, and they have so much money left over from not competing that they can buy off their regulators. And think about Google getting convicted of this illegal search monopoly. And one of the facts in that case was that Google had been paying more than $20 billion a year to Apple not to make a search engine. And so, you know, you had nowhere to go, and the regulator let them get away with it. And, you know, even after they lost that antitrust case, the court just ruled that Google could keep paying that bribe because they said, well, Apple might be spending that $20 billion to make better products for iPhone users. So it would not be fair to them to make Apple stop taking this bribe from Google. So you have regulatory capture that stops that allows companies to get away with it. You used to have powerful workers in the tech sector. I know we all make fun of tech bros, but you know, they were in such high demand and they generated so much value for their employers. There's a National Bureau of Economic Research working paper that estimates the net value that each tech worker added to a Silicon Valley firm at $1 million a year. And that's why they had like free kombucha and a ball pit and like massages and a surgeon who'd freeze their eggs so they could work through their fertile years. It was because they were worth a gargantuan amount of money to their employers, and there wasn't anyone to fill their job if they quit. And so what that meant is that to the extent that they cared about their users, and a lot of them did, they were, I call them Tron-pilled, you know, they fought for the user. These folks, when their bosses ordered them to Inshitify a product, they like missed their mother's funeral to ship on time. They just say no. And if the bosses pushed it, they'd walk across the street and have another job by lunchtime. And so, you know, as supply caught up with demand, and the fact that these workers never unionized meant that there was nothing to stand between them and their bosses when their bosses didn't need them so much, well, they were no longer in a position to fight for our rights. And then finally, we used to have this thing called interoperability, the ability to plug two or more technologies into each other. And, you know, computers, formally, there's something called Turing Complete Universal von Neumann machines, which is how computer scientists describe something that is able to run every valid program. And that means that for every gambit, every dirty trick, every 10-foot pile of shit that a tech boss installed in a product that you used, someone could make an 11-foot software ladder that would go over it. Every time they locked out generic ink on your printer, someone could write the program that unlocked it. Every time they locked you into an app store, someone could lock you out of that. Every time they invaded your privacy, someone could make a privacy protecting layer for your technology. And the thing is that over 20 years, we've just expanded IP law over and over again, often in the name of defending creative workers who, strangely enough, are making less money now than they were 20 years ago. And that has meant that we don't get that interoperability either. And so really, this is not the iron laws of economics. It's not bad consumption choices. It's not the great forces of history. It's not the callow cupidity of evil tech bosses. It is the inshitogenic policy environment created by regulators, economists, politicians who were warned at the time that they took these decisions to weaken competition law, to expand IP law, to weaken labor law. They were warned at the time that this would be the consequence, and they did it anyway. And no one blames those guys. And part of the point of this book is to put the blame where it belongs so we can fix it, so we can restore labor rights, so we can restore competition, so we can block regulatory capture. We can do all of that. And, you know, it may seem like we can't do that in America right now. Certainly Trump has like fired a lot of the referees who used to keep our bosses honest when we were unionizing or trying to stop companies from monopolizing their sector. And I think Trump is making a category error here. He thinks the reason that we have laws that protect us, or the reason that we have protection, is because of the law. And really, it's the other way around. It was our own unilateral action, the formation of illegal unions, the undertaking of illegal boycotts, that caused this labor law, this consumer law, to spring into existence. And, you know, the labor peace from the National Labor Relations Act in the 30s, that was not just about protecting workers from bosses. It was about protecting bosses from workers. And, you know, I'll give you two guesses as to which part of that law has mostly been enforced. You know, when you fire the referees, the game doesn't necessarily end, but definitely there's no more rules. And so this is the moment for us to seize the means of computation and really do something about this.
Is that the fastest you've ever done that spiel?
No, I do it all the time. I like doing it.
Yeah, well, that was great. I mean, you hit all the high points. I want to stress one of the key points here that you did hit on is that this is not just capitalism. And besides the way that this is not just capitalism in terms of how capitalism was practiced in the 20th century, I do want to take a moment and stress, and I always love this moment, and you do it in the book, and you've done it frequently in the newsletter. When we think about what capitalism was meant to be as described by people like Adam Smith, these so-called moral philosophers, they were trying to imagine a world in which no one could get richer just by owning something. And yeah, if you ask someone what capitalism is right now, they're probably like to say like, it's the system in which rich douchebags just keep getting richer because they already own stuff. This idea of capitalism, I mean, I think it's probably been what it's always been. I think Smith was probably wrong. And I don't know if there was ever a big moment where Smithian capitalism and innovation flowed. But you've pointed out in this book the problem, and then Varoufakis's book, Techno-Feudalism, is a great way of describing this, is now if you own Twitter, you've totally enshittified it. You've taken all the value to yourself. You've locked users in. They can't take their data somewhere else. You can't get broken up because the people who would break you up are working for the Trump administration, and so are you if you are the owner of Twitter. And so you're just, despite being one of the most incompetent human beings of all time, sitting there and reaping the rewards of owning this shitty thing you didn't build. And people call that capitalism, and they call you a capitalist. But if a capitalist is someone who builds a product that people like and they buy that product, that you are not a capitalist. You're a feudal lord. How does that sound?
Yeah, well, I think that you're getting at something that Yannis talks about in his book, obviously, this difference between rents and profits. You know, rents are things that you get by owning something, and profits are things you get by making something or doing something. And it's funny because, you know, you if you evince this critique in, among Germans, they will tell you that you're being structurally anti-Semitic, which is just like, as a Jew, being told that by people with Von in their name is very weird. But they're like, oh, no, you know, you can't accuse finance capital of being evil you know, parasitic, and saying that the real economy is the healthy one because that's what the Nazis did. Well, you know, the Nazis also like the great outdoors. It doesn't mean that, it, you know, enjoying fresh air makes you a Nazi. And I do think that, you know, owning factors of production is what every capitalist aspires to, but mobilizing the factors of production is what capitalists are supposed to do. And while I take your point that there was never like a golden age, there was at least maybe a silver or a bronze age of this stuff that because of the last gasps of antitrust law in the late 1970s and early 1980s, where we broke up AT&T and we nearly broke up IBM. We took IBM through a 12-year antitrust ordeal that really changed its corporate culture. And then later on, we did the same thing to Microsoft, where it went through this antitrust ordeal. And like IBM, it escaped, but it didn't escape unscathed. It was very hard on the company and on its executives. You know, the first viral video was a deposition tape of Bill Gates just being nuts in his deposition and being like childish and petulant and just really cringe. And it went VHS viral. People copied the tape and handed it around. Everyone who Bill Gates thought of as a peer saw this video and witnessed his humiliation. And as a result, you just had this incredible dynamism. You know, AT&T got broken up. Their decade-long project to block modems ended. We started to get lots of networked services, not necessarily internet services, but networked services where people were adding features to your phone jack without paying rent to AT&T. You know, if you think about like AT&T innovations, it was stuff like caller ID, where it was $6.99 a month to find out who was calling you before you picked up the phone. That never existed for email, right? You can see who the email is from before you click it and open it. And that's not because there are email providers who wouldn't like to collect that rent. It's just because that is a technical matter. This open network doesn't have the locus of control that allows for that rent collection. And so we got dynamism because the only way you could do capitalism on the internet in those early days and network services was not by figuring out how to extract rent. It was by making better products, right? By poaching customers or by bringing in new customers who didn't know that they needed the internet, but you could make the case to them for doing it. And, you know, IBM, after their 12-year antitrust ordeal, they made the PC out of commodity components rather than out of proprietary ones because the DOJ didn't like it. They didn't make their own operating system because they know the DOJ really hated tying software to hardware. And so they hired this kid called Bill Gates, who had a friend called Paul Allen and who had a company called Micro-Soft. and they made DOS. Actually, they bought DOS from someone else and sold it to IBM. And then there was this great anarchist technologist, a guy named Tom Jennings, who among other things, he founded a dial-up network called FidoNet that let different BBSs talk to each other. If you're an old BBS person, you'll remember FidoNet. He was a really key agitator during the AIDS crisis in San Francisco, and he published a zine called HomoCore. He was also a software engineer. And his employer, Phoenix, paid him to reverse engineer the Phoenix ROM, or the IBM PC ROM, which was the thing that made an IBM PC able to run IBM PC software that worked with Microsoft. So he went into a clean room and he reverse engineered the PC ROM. They made the Phoenix ROM, and that's where you got Dell and Gateway and Compaq. And IBM did not turn them into radioactive rubble because they were afraid of the DOJ coming down on them for being anti-competitive. And then, you know, Microsoft turned into IBM. They crushed Netscape the way IBM crushed so many companies. But then the DOJ got involved with them, and Bill Gates was so scarred by it that when Google came along, they didn't do it to Google. So there was this incredible dynamism. Companies rose and they fell, right? When the cupidity, the greed, the short-sightedness, the rationalization of tech bosses led them to worsen the things that we relied on, we weren't stuck with them. We went somewhere else. Their businesses failed. The smart ones didn't do it because they feared the consequences. And that was a better age than the one we're in now. And look, you know, if you love your comrades and want to fight to change the system entirely, the less predatory behavior from these platforms that they have to tolerate, the more spare resiliency they'll have to give to this project of a root and branch change of the system. You know, right now in shitification, you know, regulatory capture, lack of interoperability, weak labor force, it's doing terrible things to the people you love, right? If you're a nurse these days, chances are you're a contract nurse. Hospitals avoid staff nurses because they want to do union avoidance. And contract nurses used to be staffed through local labor agencies. There'd be two or three in every town. Now they're staffed through four giant apps, each of which calls itself Uber for nurses. And because there's no privacy law, before the nurse gets a shift, the app looks up the nurse's credit history. And if they're carrying a lot of credit card debt, they get offered a lower wage on the grounds that they're probably more economically desperate and willing to take that wage. And look, you know, nurses are the front lines of the struggle for justice in lots of ways. For one thing, they're keeping the rest of us alive and healthy, but they're also fighting for better wages, patient rights, all of those good things. And the nurse who drove Uber till midnight last night and skipped breakfast this morning to make rent because of this wage erosion through algorithmic wage discrimination, that nurse does not have a lot of spoons left over to help fight those other fights. And that's not just bad because maybe that nurse is inserting your catheter, but it's bad because that nurse is your comrade who's going to help you fix the world.
Yeah, I just can't stress enough how much I agree with this, that the world we live in, it has gotten so much worse over the last few decades, in part because of the imposition of technology everywhere and the level of control that we allow over technology, that we wouldn't, you know, the metaphor, like you wouldn't allow someone who sold you a book to come into your house and take your book because you misused it. So that's one. But then I do think,
or because you're right, they found out that they didn't have the licensing rights that they thought they had, yeah, when they sold it to you.
Yes, but the even bigger one is, yeah, there were structural setups to the relationship between American companies and the American government, especially in the post New Deal era, that got wrecked by, I mean, Carter, sure, but Reagan and Clinton, yeah, are the two biggest.
Carter pulled out a few Jenga blocks. Yeah. Reagan took him out by the fistful.
Yeah, and then Clinton was like, this is fine. We're on board with this as Democrats. And
yeah, Clinton did it while dog whistling a bunch of racist nonsense.
Yeah, yeah, but he did. What he didn't do was say, that was bad and right wing, and as the other party, we are going to be against it. He did precisely the opposite. So we've got all these things that we need technologically. We need interoperability. We need all of these. We need to own the things that we buy as opposed to just renting them. But it really comes down, as near as I can tell, to just, we need the old rules where the corporations had to be afraid of their customers and their employees rather than the customers being afraid of their corporations. I mean, to me, that's what we need. We know how to do it. We've done it before. Kim Stanley Robinson has said this before. Like, there's stuff that we know how to do. We know it works. We did it in the 30s. In some ways, it's not that hard. Inshittification is a new version of this, but it seems to me the old playbook works. Does that sound right to you?
I actually think we've got a better playbook this nice. Time around for a couple of reasons. So one is that this flexible digital technology that lets staffing agencies change a nurse's wage at every step, it's also available to us, right? Notwithstanding that IP law gets in the way, we can use digital technology, for example, to claw back privacy from our apps. And, 51% of all web users have installed an ad blocker. It's the largest consumer boycott in human history. It's illegal to do that for apps because they have digital rights management. It's illegal to break digital rights management. But, if we can reform just that law that stops you from altering the technology you use for lawful purposes, then we don't have to wait for a privacy law to be passed and enforced. All we have to do is run that software. We can take what, it's sometimes called in political circles self-help, right? We can help ourselves there. We don't have to wait for lawmakers to step in and fight our corner. That's very good, right? That's a huge advantage here. And the other advantage, as a part of that, the advantage of digital is that we can coordinate, right? I grew up as an activist riding a bicycle through the streets of Toronto, like all the best Americans, I'm Canadian. And I would have a bucket of wheat paste in my bike basket and a stack of flyers to get people out to a protest at the weekend. And I'd be out there all night, wheat pasting these things to telephone poles. And, if you think that we can organize a mass movement without telecommunications technology, I want you to spend a couple of nights in sub-zero temperature with a bucket of wheat paste and tell me how you feel about it afterwards. It's easy to romanticize this. But the other thing that's really interesting here is that multinational firms that build this kind of technology, that do this kind of technology, they are operating in a foundationally different way from the way that the monopolists of the Gilded Age operated. So you take someone like John D. Rockefeller and his Standard Oil Company. In America, the Standard Oil Company maintained its monopoly through control over pipelines and refineries, and to a lesser extent, wells. What that meant was that American regulators, they were enforcing against these harms that came out of pipelines, that came out of refineries, but not the same harms that John D. Rockefeller was wreaking on the German economy, which had to do with the monopolization of their ports. And so while they might have had a common enemy, they didn't have a common struggle, right? They had a completely different set of struggles, completely different set of fact patterns. If you successfully prosecuted John D. Rockefeller in Pennsylvania, that wouldn't help you do it in Munich. When we look at the tech companies, they're doing the same scams everywhere, right? The thing that a tech company does in Germany is the same as the thing that a tech company does in Ghana, and it's the same that a tech company does in Canada and in the US. And you have seen an enormous amount of work by these companies, or by these regulators rather, where they're collaborating across borders. Where, you get a successful case built in the United Kingdom, the EU picks it up and runs with it, and then that is taken to Japan and South Korea and used there. And so you can build these, forgive me, coalitions of the willing, right? where different regulators from different countries can work together.
I think we're going to have to explain coalition of the willing sooner or later to our younger listeners. Yeah. Yeah. But that'll be for another day. Corey, thanks so much for coming on. I know you don't have much time. Anything else you want to say before I let you run away to another dozen podcast interviews?
Yeah, well, that's exactly what I'm doing. I'm getting in my car and driving over to the HeadGum Studios to talk to Adam from Adam Ruins Everything for his podcast. Thank you very much for your interest. And thank you, to my fellow leftists for not just reflexively saying, hey, this is just capitalism. It's a distinction without a difference. Thank you for putting in the time to understand that there is a real substantial difference here, and that it is a difference that means something to the people you love and that you want to work with to change the world.
Yeah, I Thank you, Corey. Thank you.
Thank you.